You're listening to continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
So if it's stated a person may voluntarily...
Right, I would just start. We would start with a person and then go through the end of that.
And I'm just comparing it to the 324A instruction that we have, just to make
sure. All right, which one? Oh, you didn't number yours.
I didn't. I apologize. That is... four or five down. It starts with person who undertakes gratuitously.
Yeah, I had actually matched that up with instruction C, but I guess it's pretty close to what we're doing. All right.
So, in other words, if Your Honor were to instruct a person on B, this is their version B, striking the word, however, a person may voluntarily assume a legal duty to protect another from third-party conduct, the concern I have there is the proffer of 324A doesn't talk about third-party conduct. And 324A is what we've been guiding, what's been guiding this case from Burns v. Gag.
Right. All right, so are you in receipt of, once again, they didn't number or letter them, but it starts a person who undertakes gratuitously. All right, so basically, what is your objection to that restatement of Burns?
Well, Judge, if I may address your question this way, I think that the... our instruction B gets at a separate issue from our instruction C. You've seen our instruction C and you've aligned that as corresponding to their Burns instruction. We'll just call it the Burns instruction. That is because instruction B is getting at the broader idea. The jury needs to know that, in general, no one has an obligation, no one has a duty to exercise reasonable care to protect another from harm. They don't have an affirmative obligation to do that. That's what Restatement Section 314 is about. And why I think that's appropriate in this case, Judge, is because if you look at the cases, all the cases we relied on, including Burns, A.H. Terry, all those cases, they always, whenever they start explaining, okay, what is the assumed duty doctrine, what is that, they always start off by saying, in general, there is no obligation to protect another from third-party harm. That's always how they started off. And that's what this instruction is getting at. It's letting the jury know, hey, everyone, understand, ordinarily there's no duty to act affirmatively to protect another from third-party harm. And that's important in this case, because that is what's at issue here, third-party harm, harm by this child, JT. In terms of my problem with their instruction, it's not numbered, obviously, but their Burns instruction, I acknowledge that this is pulls the language roughly from Burns. Burns, let me just emphasize, was also a third-party harm case. That was a criminal assault by a student. That was an assault. That was a tort. That was a crime. That was third-party harm, and that's exactly what it talked about in that case. There's the case law interpreting the restatement, and there's the restatement's language. Sometimes what the restatement says, Judge, does not say everything that the case law has expanded upon and elaborated and filled in the gaps. This is a skeletal outline of what the law is. So my objections to theirs are number one, it's incomplete. But number two, if you look at our instruction C, we do a couple of things.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet.
I'm sorry.
I don't think.
Well, but you had us, I may have misunderstood, Judge, but I understood you to ask me, what is the problem with their Burns instruction?
All right, go ahead.
One problem is subsection B. Subsection B is lifted straight from the restatement, and yes, it appears in Burns. I agree. But as I've argued, Judge, if you look at section 324A, which is what Burns parrots and adopts, that subsection only applies in those cases where it's like, it's a security company, they have a contract to fulfill somebody else's obligation to protect people. We've heard no evidence of that whatsoever. That subsection B has no application in this case. And Rather, what will happen is that will create confusion. We talked about having voluminous instructions, stuff that might lead to confusion by the jury and mislead them. This is a prime example, because there is no evidence to support it. There's not even at least a scintilla of evidence to support it. And because of that, it should be struck. In addition, I know we haven't gotten to see, but we add and emphasize that the restatement is written in with the baseline ordinary simple negligence in mind. That is why it talks about an exercise of a reasonable, exercise of a reasonable degree of care. That's how the language is couched in 324A. That's how it's applied in Burns as well. But none of those cases, they needed to have additional instructions clarifying that this is a gross negligence case. And so when we get to it at the appropriate time, I want to highlight that I've combined, not only have I done what plaintiff's counsel has done here, I have pulled in the language straight from Burns. I have eliminated subsection B, which has no application to this case. And I added a third paragraph emphasizing that mere simple negligence is insufficient as a matter of law to establish liability in this case. It has got to be gross. So that is why.
All right, I'm denying defendant's instruction B, granting plaintiff's competing instruction with that. And then along with that, unless you wanted to be heard on defendant C, I was going to grant that in conjunction with yours.
Grant his C in conjunction with ours.
With yours, right. I think that they both state the law clearly. I do not believe they're competing. So that we would offer yours that competed with their B, which I'm striking, and I will allow them to offer C as a correct correct instruction and statement of the law.
Your Honor, the concern I have here is that their instruction C has prongs A and B in the paragraph, the top paragraph. Our instruction, which you've approved, has an A, B, C. Then when we get to similarly on the next line, there's an A, they have an A, B, where our instruction has an A, B, C. And then finally, this paragraph at the bottom that says, regardless of the above general principles, the court instructs the jury that in this particular case, merely proving that Dr. Ebony Parker failed to exercise reasonable care to perform an assumed duty to protect Ms. Zwerner from third-party criminal harm, there we are again with the word, is insufficient to impose liability. I don't think that that's a correct statement of the law in a vacuum. In other words, Your Honor will instruct them that it's a question of gross negligence, which is in the finding instruction, not simple negligence. So they know that it has to be gross. But when we get to this issue of cumulative conduct in the Chapman versus City of Virginia Beach case, instructing them that, you know, it's just effectively you don't have to worry about the failed exercise of reasonable care isn't a correct statement of the law. It is that in conjunction with other things. And then it goes on in the next sentence and talks about third-party criminal harm again, which, again, this is not.
All right, you have a response?
Judge, I stand on the propriety of my original instructions, but I have a suggestion. Take it for what it's worth. If the court's inclined to grant their instruction, or Burns' instruction, then perhaps we can just add the third paragraph of instruction C to emphasize that here this is a gross case. This is a gross negligence case. We can also tailor and eliminate the reference to criminal harm with the understanding that we're talking about third-party harm and the same express undertaking doctrine would apply in that context.
All right, so you would strike the first two paragraphs and then you would modify the third paragraph of your instruction C.
I think that would be fine. I'd also tell the court there's a separate instruction in our set somewhere in here that basically thanks, not redundant, but is a refrain. It repeats the principle that this is a gross negligence case. So my main thing is, if the court is inclined to reject ours, grant theirs, we need to have an instruction that is explicit, unequivocal, and clear to the jury. This is a gross negligence
case.
Correct,
and they're in agreement with that. So let me let you work on modifying that third paragraph.
I've just handed him, if it's helpful, a red line that I was working on over the weekend, which effectively says it's that top part of the 324A, which Your Honor's approved. And then it says, this is called an assumed duty of care, just to explain to the jury, that's what that word is, assumed duty of care. And then the next line says, if you find that the defendant breached the standard with gross negligence, then you shall find for the plaintiff, and if Your Honor permits the contrib, which we're objecting to, we could modify that to say, with gross negligence, you shall find for the plaintiff unless the plaintiff was contributory negligent and their contributory negligence proximately caused the injury.
Okay. All right. So why don't I let you all work on that until we come back on Wednesday?
Yes, sir.
Right, and we're striking criminal. Correct. All right. That brings us to D. Plaintiffs be offered. Your plaintiff's position?
Yeah, Judge, I don't think any of this is necessary when we have 324A being instructed to the jury. We certainly object to this definition or description of express undertaking. I mean, criminal harm is littered throughout the instruction. And then this recitation of an implied undertaking is insufficient to create an assumed duty to protect another from criminal harm. That might be true, but again, this isn't about criminal harm. And so it's inapplicable in the context of this case.
All right. Your argument?
Judge, it's a red herring to distinguish criminal harm versus intentional versus just third-party harm. These same principles, the express undertaking requirement, has been implemented in all these cases, regardless of whether it's criminal or intentional or otherwise. The point is that where the harm is perpetrated by a third party, who's an individual who's not a party to the litigation, it would be generally be unforeseeable as a matter of law, except if there's a special relationship or an assumed duty. And we're talking about assumed duty here. And so, again, I want to highlight in the court, this should raise red flags for the court, because what is happening is counsel is trying to, well, I would argue that this is a tactic to take us outside of the realm of the doctrine requiring an express undertaking by drawing some distinction between, well, this isn't really criminal harm, this isn't really intentional harm, therefore the undertaking need not be expressed, it can just be implied, just like in the motorist cases. Just wave somebody over through implied conduct, there you got your assumed undertaking. That's not how this works. The case law is clear. If you look at Age Church of God in Christ, if you look at Terry, you look at all these cases. You look at Kellerman, you look at all these cases. They always say that an express undertaking is required. It's what we've been arguing about for months and months and months up to this case. You can't circumvent that requirement. This is not the way to do it. Drawing a distinction between criminal and intentional harm and saying this kid can't form mens rea, that's not the way to do it. They're going to do that. The way to argue that is what they argued previously, is that there is some latitude, there's some suggestion in the case law that conduct tantamount to express undertaking may be sufficient. And I would contend, Judge, that is taken from AH, that is not the law, that did not alter the standard in Terry versus Irish Fleet. This standard remains unequivocal, it's gotta be expressed. This instruction, all the authorities cited right there for you, Judge. I'll just stand on that authority. Take a look at those cases, it will tell you, it says these things. It says them verbatim. I didn't make this up. The implied undertaking is insufficient to create an assumed duty to protect another from third party. Just take out criminal. The same thing applies. The same thing applies. That is a red herring.
I would not
your
take
position is it's inapplicable, correct?
Yeah, and I would not take his word on that. That being the law, Judge. The cornerstone of all of these cases is that somebody was murdered or sexually abused, by an adult. That's all of these cases. We do not have a murder or a sexual assault committed by an adult. It is a six-year-old, as they've made patently clear. And I'm sorry that that's what the law is, but that's what the law is. It doesn't require, Burns v. Gagnon does not say what they wanted to say in this instruction. And that is why Burns v. Gagnon isn't listed once in their recitation of the law, of their citation of this instruction.
All right, I think it's more consistent with my prior ruling that this instruction is inapplicable to this case based on all the rulings we've made, both pre-trial and at trial. So I'm going to deny that objection noted. All right, E, I've got competing, I do have one competing with plaintiff, it looks like. This is the starts off, E, making a contract or gratuitous product promise. Yours starts off, if you find the defendant undertook to render services.
Yeah, I don't think we need the if you find instruction.
If you don't need yours?
Correct. If
okay.
we included, as it sounds like from Your Honor's comments before, that 324A is going to have a sentence underneath that says, you know, you can only find gross negligence in what you've asked us to confer on, which, if that's contained within that instruction, this instruction that is, if you find the defendant undertook, I don't think is necessary okay. at that point.
And what about your E? Do you find that that's necessary then, if we clarifying in the other instruction?
That is a difficult question to answer, Judge, because what's happened with the elimination of the prior instruction, Judge, is a seismic shift in the landscape of this case. It basically eliminated
but
the expression.
Do you disagree? It's inconsistent with my rulings. Up to this point.
Striking the last instruction.
Right.
I believe if my understanding of the court's prior rulings and the arguments that were raised on the motions for summary judgment was that the nature of the argument was that under AH versus Church of God in Christ, conduct tantamount to an express undertaking may be sufficient. That is what was argued. That is what was litigated. That is different in kind from saying, look, stuff doesn't need to be expressed because this is not criminal harm or intentional harm. The argument was, hey, we've got a case, AH, Church of God in Christ, that embellished the Terry standard. And so it would still be proper, like the posture of this case would be, the jury would still need to determine, well, look, these interactions, each of these reporting parties like Kovac and Rawls, when they go in and talk to Dr. Parker, was it reasonable for them to construe her conduct, her demeanor, her statements in context? Would it be reasonable to construe that as her manifesting an intent to undertake a duty to protect them? That's completely in line with all the cases I've talked about, Judge. I would argue that striking this prior jury instruction D, based on counsel's new argument that this is not criminal conduct, that this is not intentional harm, is completely different. And it puts the case in a different posture because now it does make instruction E potentially less relevant. Instruction E is something that ties into the express undertaking doctrine, which we talked about, and that's still AH, that's still Terry, that's also Burns. And Burns was also an express undertaking case, Judge. They seized on the fact that the principal literally said, I'm gonna check, look into this. So there has to be some statement here, and I think this instruction is appropriate because not only that, a promise or agreement alone is insufficient, you actually have to have entry into actual performance of the undertaking. I will acknowledge that is a bit more of a stretch in the case law. Kinzer is a concurrence. I know that, Judge. But I think that part of why this instruction is important and meaningful is because instruction D was meaningful and important. And I don't think striking it for the reasons counsel has raised for the first time now in this proceeding and the recent proceedings is appropriate.
All right. I'm going to deny that it's not a correct statement of the law and you're withdrawing your competing, correct, Mr. Binninghausen?
Yes, sir.
All right. All right, that brings us to F. I did not have anything directly competing.
It'd be hard.
Judge, candidly, I don't know where to begin. I mean, I think it's...
For all the reasons previously stated.
Yes, Judge. Thank you.
All right. All right. Based on my prior rulings, do you have anything else you want to say?
Judge, I would just suggest that the place to begin would be the restatement. The restatement contemplates reliance. It's expressed there. It's been adopted by the court, Burns and Terry and AH. and they built and expanded on the case law, and they've articulated exactly what reliance means. Without this instruction, the jury's not going to know what reliance means. They're not going to have any idea.
All right, consistent with my prior ruling, I'm going to deny this instruction and noted objection. All right, that gets us to G.
Judge, I think it's inapplicable and unnecessary in light of the other, the approved instruction on what an assumed duty of care is. Littered with the criminal language as well.
All right, anything else you want to say on that?
Judge, I stand on my prior arguments, and I just emphasize that the path we are going down is basically making a, I would argue that this is like a caricature of the facts of the case. This is transforming this from a third-party harm case, which requires an express undertaking, to a novel, an ordinary run-of-the-mill negligence case. This is anything but that.
Well, based on an assumption of care. I mean, we agree on that, right?
Yes, Judge.
Okay. All right, for the previously cited reasons, I'm going to deny instruction. All right, so H, defendants H.
Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary. The instruction that we've already, that Your Honor has already ruled on, talks about increasing the risk of harm. This just says it again, and then adds language as it relates to criminal conduct.
Yeah, and do you have any argument as to how that's applicable?
Judge, with respect to any reference to criminal conduct, again, this is that could be eliminated, converted to third-party harm. It would have the same impact. I thought the purpose of this instruction, Judge, is that, again, it is highlighting that when you look at the restatement, it talks about what the increased risk of harm prong is. You just need to remind the jury this is a gross negligence case. Provided, Judge, that we have an instruction that adequately informs the jury that gross negligence is the standard.
Which we will, yeah.
Then I think I stand on my prior arguments.
I denied the same reasons previously stated, but also with the caveat that we are going to define grossly negligent. All right. Did we have an I?
Yeah, there's a J.
Yeah, I did not get an I. Is that correct? Okay.
I have one in front of you, Judge.
All right, very good. So now we are on to J. All right, you're assuming, claiming this was not an issue in this case.
It was not, Judge. Dr. Ebony Parker never pled a constitutional right. And if she has not exercised the constitutional right, it's not appropriate to instruct the jury on the constitutional right.
Any response?
Judge, I understand the argument. I would just emphasize that my client has exercised her Fifth Amendment rights by not testifying. I understand that the dynamics are different in this little case. The case law talking about whether you can straight up refuse to take the stand versus take the stand and selectively invoke is actually somewhat ambiguous. I know this has been tried previously in our prior arguments and pretrial proceedings in this case, Judge, but I would argue that my client has, in fact, invoked her Fifth Amendment privilege. Otherwise, she would have testified. And I ask the court to instruct the jury not to draw any adverse interest against my inference against my client based on that. And that is consistent with 8.01-223.1, which prohibits drawing any inference or penalizing someone for exercising a constitutional right in generally in civil cases.
But she didn't invoke her constitutional right in front of the jury, so that's going to be denied. All right, I have no K, so we're on to L, I believe.
Yes, Judge, the party was not impeached. That's generally my position on this. If a party's not impeached, it's improper to instruct the jury.
All right, so plaintiff had a competing one, you're withdrawing.
Correct. Well,
Oh, you had the witness.
We had a witness impeachment. Okay. We didn't have a party impeachment.
All right, instruction L, she didn't testify, so withdrawn.
Judge, I may have misconstrued this, but I want to clarify. I think this instruction is appropriate because Ms. Werner did testify and acknowledged on the stand that she was not truthful with her clinician. She wasn't impeached through prior inconsistent statements. She is a party in this case. So I think I understand counsel disagrees.
All of us.
All right, you want to?
Your Honor, that's not a prior inconsistent statement. In fact, it's a truthful statement. She said, were you truthful? Did you tell the truth to him? She says, no. She was not impeached on anything. There's no specific statement. And the language of the instruction tells us why it's not appropriate. If a party is impeached, the jury can conclude that the statement made that they were impeached with is in fact true, rather than the statement they made in court. That's why this instruction differs from the witness instruction. If a witness is impeached, the witness's impeachment can only be taken to the credibility of the witness. It cannot be taken to determine that the statement previously made was in fact true, and the statement now made is now false. And so we had no interaction with Ms. Werner where they said, you said this before and you say this now. That never occurred. And if that never occurred, there was no impeachment by a prior inconsistent statement. And without that, there's no scintilla of evidence to be able to provide it.
So what is the scintilla of evidence you're relying on?
Judge, I just disagree with the characterization of whether or not this constituted an impeachment. I think that this was an impeachment of Ms. Werner. She did acknowledge that she was not truthful with her clinician, but that is reading between the lines. She's acknowledging that she previously made a false representation to someone. That's impeachment by prior consistent statement.
All right, I'm going to grant it. All right, next one I have is P.
I object to this routinely. I think the jury is going to be told what the issues are. The jury is going to be told how to find the issues. Telling them just because someone's injured doesn't mean you recover is just superfluous. But I understand it's in the BMJI.
Right, it's a model instruction. All right. I'm going to allow that. All right, Q. That's the gross negligence instruction we've been discussing.
This is the...
their Q.
Correct.
All right, any objections? Or what are the objections, I guess I should say?
No objection, Judge.
All right. Objection withdrawn. Instruction Q is granted.
Your Honor, I will flag, just this is Your Honor's preference. We did discuss it in conferral. After the parties are introduced in the preliminary part of the instructions, my preference is, especially if there's only one plaintiff and one defendant, you say the plaintiff or the defendant, or at least shorten their names, because it's going to be a tongue twister for you to be going through all of these and saying all the letters and things of that nature. So that's Your Honor's discretion, but that's something we discussed.
Okay. Did you want to be heard on that?
Just shortening the names is appropriate, Judge. I think that's fine.
Okay. Yeah, let's just indicate it in one of the intro instructions that the plaintiff will herein be referred to as, or Abigail Werner will herein be referred to as plaintiff, Dr. Ebony Parker be, you know, referred to as defendant. All right, on to R. Any objection to that? We got competing experts.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to figure out what's modified in it.
Yeah, can you
go ahead.
Checking on this. But I think it's just a crayon she uses.
Oh, okay.
I believe, but
that's
please
fine.
Help
check. Yeah, yeah. It's just a pronoun modification, so I'm okay with it.
All right, friend.
Again, Kevin, if you see something different.
Yeah, I understand.
All right, T. More than one proximate cause.
Mm-hmm. this is a essentially a, an intro to a superseding cause instruction, Your Honor. There is a multiple proximate causes, but that's in cases where there's multiple parties to assess, and we don't have multiple parties to assess.
And you're I'm assuming argument that there was no superseding cause.
Correct. We don't believe there's been a superseding cause.
Okay. All right, but we are offering there is another proximate cause definition in there somewhere, right?
There's the standard proximate cause that's been agreed to, which says a proximate cause. It just doesn't go into there may be multiple proximate causes.
All right. So, any argument that there is any evidence of a superseding negligence here?
There is, Judge. I would emphasize that for that doctrine to apply, you need not be a party to the action that is a superseding cause. It could be a non-party. This was addressed recently in Reston versus anesthesiologist. It's a 2025 unpublished decision. And that that one's really important because multiple experts testified and opined that the conduct of the non-party physician was, quote, unprecedented, was extremely rare. That's what we're dealing with in this case, Judge. And that's proper fodder for the jury to consider and determine, look, was the shooter, was the six-year-old child, was that an independent, was that a superseding intervening cause? And so that's consistent, that aligns with the Reston case, Judge. I understand there's differences. I understand that's a malpractice case. I'd also, for the court's consideration, to some extent, the assumption of duty doctrine. It does not subsume the superseding cause analysis. They are, they complement each other. But I've not found a case where it's dealt with, it characterized something as a superseding cause. I would argue, though, in this case, given the unprecedented nature of this and how it aligns well with Reston, that this is appropriate instruction, it's an accurate statement of the law, and it's supported by at least a scintilla of evidence.
Right. You object to superseding cause?
I object, Your Honor.
I'm going to deny that, and I don't find a superseding cause exists in this case. All right, you. Yeah, so once again, same objections noted and denied. Objections preserved. W. Now, I know there's competing plaintiffs to this as well.
I think we can clean this one up. I understand the objection to ours because we didn't have the language gross negligence. I presume that that was the objection. So we can include that. The thing that I want to, once we clean that up, this should be permissible. My preference is to split up any physical pain from any mental anguish in two different prongs. That's a difference between the two as well, because those are two, in my view, two separate damages.
Right, but I'm not preventing you from arguing them separately, right?
Correct.
All right, well, does the model...
The model has them together, Judge.
Together, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to deny that motion. I'm going to do exactly what the model says, but adding gross negligence. So any objection with those rulings?
No, Your Honor.
All right. And I will have asked that defense prepare that.
Understood, Judge.
All right, we have Z.
Is it duty to mitigate, Your Honor?
Yes.
I don't think there's been a scintilla of evidence of mitigation as an issue in this case. Every witness has testified to her diligence. In fact, we've heard a lot about cosmetology school. So I think in this case, the mitigation is not an issue.
All right, any argument?
Judge, I just respectfully disagree. The evidence established that Ms. Warner may not have been forthcoming with the clinicians about some of her medical history.
Right, and then she went to cosmetology school. Yep. All right, I'm going to grant that over plaintiff's objection. But it's otherwise a correct statement of the law, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right, double A.
Your Honor, I don't think that there's been a pre-existing condition issue in this case.
I'm assuming you're referring to PTSD.
I believe there was evidence of that, Judge.
I think there's evidence that she had been previously diagnosed with it.
She had a history of depression and anxiety, Judge.
Right. But it doesn't specify one. It says a pre-existing condition.
But I think we need to address... I think you have to address the totality of the instruction in that context. And she may recover from the aggravation and from the increased severity or difficulty of the treatment, but she is not entitled to recover for the pre-existing condition. We don't, again, there is no evidence from the defense as to what that pre-existing condition is that we are seeking to seek recovery for. Our expert acknowledged that she had a history of depression and anxiety, and that she had new onset post-traumatic stress disorder. And then you have all the physical injuries, of course, which I don't think are disputed.
Yes.
Plaintiff's counsel has the obligation and burden to establish the damages. Their own evidence established that Ms. Warner suffered from some pre-existing underlying conditions. The jury is going to be asked, counsel has said it's like appraising a diamond. You're going to have to figure out how to assess and attach a dollar figure to her damages. If the law here in this instruction tells them, look, if you conclude that any of this condition, any of her damages arose from a pre-existing condition,
I think there was valid testimony, or testimony that the jury could find was true, so I'm going to grant that. All right, AB.
Statement, which is we have to prove gross negligence. I think it's redundant, but
I'm going to grant that. AC, definition of gross negligence.
It's just a modification, Your Honor. So we have a competing instruction on this.
That's yes, you do. I got it.
And ours is verbatim to the VMJI.
All right, so it looks like you added some case law and wanted to add quotes. Is that correct?
It's model plus, Judge. And I can speak to why that's appropriate.
All right. Yeah, I'm gonna deny defendants grant plaintiffs.
Judge, may I just be heard for the record? I'll be very brief. I think that it's important. Ordinarily, model instructions fairly cover the issues, but it's not sufficient in this case. I think that the language that's used in the definition of gross negligence is not the way ordinary jurors talk. Nobody knows what slight diligence or the want of even step. No one talks like that. No one understands what that means. The second paragraph, the standard for gross negligence is one of indifference, not inadequacy, comes straight out of the case law interpreting the definition. That's crystal clear. That's how the jury can make the decision in this case. I'd ask, Judge, if you refuse this instruction, that in closing argument, counsel be permitted to argue to the jury and explain that this is the gross negligence standard, because that is black letter law.
Well, I mean, you can you can make your arguments,
Thank you.
I'm just not going to instruct them as to that.
Understood.
Okay.
I would just say, you can't tell them what the law is unless it's in the instruction.
Right. I mean, but they can say that the evidence that they proved matched what the law is, or what the instruction is. All right, instruction AD.
Plaintiff has a duty to exercise her medical decisions. This is just our...
Your objections to... So it's a...
Both. It's also modified, and I'm not quite sure what the modification is, but...
First sentence.
What was that?
The first sentence is the only modification.
So it should... The VMJS says contributory negligence is the failure to act as a reasonable person would have acted for her own safety under the circumstances of this case. First sentence should go out. It's not in the VMJI. And then for the...
You're arguing no contrib.
I know. We're arguing no contrib in this context, Your Honor.
Okay. So I'm going to overrule the plaintiff's objection to contrib. I do think there's evidence to support a jury and an argument as to that. But I'm going to ask that it match the Virginia model jury instructions.
Understood, Your Honor.
All right. Objection noted by plaintiff. And that also goes for AE. I want that to match the model jury instruction over plaintiff's objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And for what it's worth, I believe that one does comport with the model. I'll double check.
Okay, I think it does too. Well, let's see. Just besides the gender. Thank you, Magnolia.
I'll double check for it.
All right. A F.
Same objection, Your Honor. It's still on the issue of contributory negligence. I understand it's a correct statement of the law, but okay. I'm preserving my objection on contributory.
All right. Allowed. Objection preserved. All right. A H.
I think we have a model competing.
All right. Let me see. What does yours start with, Mr. Benyazin?
Defendant Ebony Parker is not required to have anticipated or foreseen the precise injury.
Yeah.
This is how it starts.
All right, I do find that.
Ken, can I do a short circuit, please? Mine's model plus. So?
Ours is model, theirs is modified.
So, agree to model.
All right.
I could just streamline the argument, Judge. Mine is model, but for the second paragraph. The second paragraph simply adds and clarifies that this is a gross negligence standard. If there's a proper and appropriate instruction elsewhere that instructs the jury on that, then that's sufficient.
Okay. I'm going to deny defendants grant. All right, defendants AI.
This is the finding instruction. I think if we ought to just mirror it to Your Honor's instructions earlier as it relates to your instruction A.
Okay. You just have the two prongs, they have the five plus the two.
Correct. So it should just be two for us, one, two, three, four.
Okay. And defendant's objections noted, consistent with my prior rulings granted plaintiffs. All right, I've got an AJ.
AJ, this is the Collins v. Nickens issue, Judge. Collins v. Nickens. I don't know if you prefer to be heard by us or them first.
Let me read it. Okay. So this is defendant's offer. Did you have any competing or you?
We don't have any competing.
All right. I will hear then from defendant first and your response.
Judge, to begin, this instruction is informed and is consistent with the court's ruling on the prior motions in limine. Before trial, the defense moved to exclude any reference to the handwritten policies or internal safety rules and procedures. And the reason was largely because case law is firmly settled that doesn't establish the standard of care or the existence of a legal duty. The court, I believe, held that this can be offered for other purposes. Case law, there's a Riverside case which is cited right there that says it can't be admissible if offered for other purposes. If you do that, I ask the court that impose also couple this instruction. I mean, if the court did that, then a cautionary instruction would be appropriate to make sure that the jury doesn't construe this for some inadmissible purpose.
All right, any response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think, I want to say it's inapplicable, and for the reasons we stated in our motion in limine argument on this issue. Godsey and Pullen both involve situations in which a corporate defendant had created standards and policies, and then those were being used against the corporate defendant who made the standards and policies to say that they were negligent and by breaching those standards and policies. The evidence in this case does not reflect that. The standards and policies that have come into evidence in this case, were not created by this defendant. And if they weren't created by this defendant, then this case law is inapplicable to the issue in dispute. And then if we go on to the next issue and say, okay, well, what can they use it for, even if Your Honor finds that Pullen and Godsey are applicable here? The language, the language that says those written policies and procedures do not establish the governing standard or the existence of a legal duty in this case, I think is an impermissible statement of the law, which is that all of these all of this information is pertinent to the determination of the governing standard of care. In fact, their witness said so when she talked about we had redirect in testimony about what does somebody do with a tier one, what does somebody do with a tier three. There was questions about what are the appropriate standards if they're written in the school context. And so
here's what I'd like you to do then. I would like you to draft, I understand you're objecting to it, draft a competing one that meets what you're you're saying. And I think we can do that. Both sides will object, that's fine. But I think if you could draft one with some language that you believe is appropriate based on what we've heard in this case, I'll consider that at this time. So I'll withhold one of that for Wednesday.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay. But I do think it's appropriate to tell them that. It's a matter of how we tell them that. All right. This is to take up Wednesday. Okay. Obviously, on the separate verdict forms that were offered, same objections based on the court's earlier findings. So at this time, with leave to modify based on anything that happens Wednesday, I'm going to deny the defendants and allow the plaintiffs.
There are some in the plaintiff's
yes.
version that haven't been addressed.
Correct.
I know you've got somewhere to be. So.
That's my agreed. Okay. So I've got five, I think. All right. So the first, and I'll just go through what I have, and then you can correct me if there's anything we're missing. First one I have, if you believe from the evidence that a witness previously made a statement. Okay. Standing on that?
Correct.
All right. And you have an objection to that?
I don't. I think this is okay. Because of the other related instruction.
All right. Granted. All right. Negligence is the failure to use ordinary care. Model instruction. Any objection to that?
That's our proffer, Judge. Okay.
Judge, our objection is related. This is tethered to the other instruction that's derived from Chapman. I think it would be inappropriate to instruct the jury on simple negligence where the issue here is gross.
Well, we're going to do both. So we'll read. I'm going to overrule that. We'll read negligence first and then gross negligence.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm going to note right before gross. Mm-hmm. Okay. Burden on the plaintiff the burden is on the plaintiff to prove greater weight of the evidence each item of damage. All right, it's a model instruction. All right. Objection to that?
I'm sorry, Judge. I'm not on the same page. This is their recitation of the five prongs for damages.
No, this is just each item of, this goes before that one. This one says each item of damage she claims to prove that each item was caused by the defendant's negligence, it's not required the exact amount, so on.
I think it's model.
Okay, granted. All right, several acts of negligence, this is the Chapman instruction, several acts of negligence which separately may not amount to gross when combined may have a cumulative effect. All right, that is derived from case law and your position.
My position is this, Judge. I think that 2 points. First of all, that case law, I just want to be clear, and I would propose that I be allowed to draft a competing instruction that refines this a little bit. Why is because the Chapman case, yes, it did hold that where there's evidence of multiple acts of simple negligence, in some circumstances, a jury may infer that that amounts to gross negligence. What that case law, including Howard, which built on that, what that case law it does not say is that I don't want the jury to misconstrue that law as saying in any case where there is multiple acts of simple negligence, that equates to gross negligence. That is not what the law is. The
law. So you want leave to basically draft a competing one based on my other rulings I've already made?
Correct, Judge.
All right. I'm going to allow them to draft a competing one, and we'll talk about it Wednesday.
Yes, Judge.
All All right, and then last is I have when a public official could reasonably foresee that she would be expected to take affirmative action to protect a specific person or class of persons from harm, that public official owes a special duty to exercise reasonable care for their protection based on Burns. All right, are you want that? All right, your position?
The court has ruled on this.
Yeah. I'm going to agree. I'm going to deny that based on my prior ruling. So
just incorporating prior arguments.
Correct. All right. Not plaintiff objects. All right, did I miss anything? I have everything else as
I think we're good, Your Honor.
Agreed to. All right, hallelujah. All right. Thank you very much. And I believe that concludes the matters we can take up today. All right. And what I would ask is, based on my rulings, if you two can talk tomorrow and try to get a set of jury instructions in the order you would prefer. I do reserve the right to reorder them at based on my rulings on Wednesday on the other things we're talking about. But if you can't agree on the order, then just give me two separate, based on my rulings, the order that you prefer, and I'm going to redo them anyway, so it's up to you. All right. Any other direction needed before we recess for the evening? All right. Thank you very much. Once again, I appreciate both sides. The representations of their clients have been second to none, and I appreciate you moving forward with this, moving forward on Wednesday morning, and allowing me to handle my recovery court docket, which is very important to me, on Wednesday, and then we'll finish up the jury instructions, and then we will have instructions first and then closing arguments, at which time we will randomly choose the two alternate jurors.
I have a question. Some courts close the courtroom for the recovery court. Is yours closed until?
It is, and that includes the media. We can't have any media for that. Okay, but we'll make it clear, Deputy Hopkins. You're going to be with me, right? You're not trying to take Wednesday off, are you? Okay, he'll be here.
I could give him the order.
He'll take care of everything as always. Thank you, Deputy. All right, thank you all very much. Have a good night, and everyone vote.
Please rise.
More continuing coverage of the Abby Zwirner civil trial is coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a moment. From the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.